the Bible is the Isaac saga, or the Isaac stories. As the Abraham stories are the stories of the patriarch, you might say, the head of the house, Terah. And so each one of the three major patriarchal cycles is designated by the name of the patriarch at the beginning. Terah, who's the father of Haran and Laban and so forth, and Abraham. And then you have Isaac, who is the father of Jacob and Esau, and then Jacob, who is the father of Joseph and his brothers. So we turn straight away to chapter 25 of Genesis, and basically we'll just be looking at the material and seeing what it has to say for us in our day and age, but first and foremost by looking at the text fairly closely. I have to admit in advance that this was work that I've done a fair bit of work on, in the sense that it was the focus of my doctoral studies when I did my doctorate. So I've got a bit of an unfair advantage, and you'll have every reason to blame me if I stumble here and there, because one never immerses oneself in material more thoroughly than when one's doing a doctorate, as Lois would aver, I'm sure. It all begins in verse 19, really. The previous saga, you might say, or family story of Terah, which focuses, of course, on Abraham, concludes with the descendants of Ishmael. And so there we have the descendants of Ishmael in chapter 25, verses 12 and following, the Ishmaelites. Immediately then, in verse 19, the descendants of, the story of, the family story of, the saga of, how do we describe this material? It really is an ongoing family saga of Isaac, right? So it's the family story of Isaac, and yet it's all about Jacob. Of course, Jacob and Esau. Isaac, 40 years old, this is verse 19, when he married Rebekah, daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean, the Syrian, very much come back into the news these days, is it not? Syria, capital of Damascus, the oldest capital city continuing to this day on the planet, interestingly, Padan Aram, sister of Laban the Aramean. This is family stuff. Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife because she was barren. As who else was barren? Sarah, you might say. Get to the New Testament, and we find Rachel, of course, was barren. And in the New Testament, Elizabeth, the mother, John the Baptist, is barren. Hannah, of course, yeah. So, mother of Samuel. So, a great deal of barrenness, which means death, which means infertility, which means that if the person who is barren is given a child, of course, that is divine initiative. A new beginning to the story. A wonderful new beginning to the story is imminent. And the Lord granted his prayer, and she conceived. I love verse 22, the children together struggled together within her. I like to call this the great intrauterine, international altercation. Or international intrauterine altercation. Now that would be quite something, would it not? Two nations. Not two people, but two nations. Not simply twins, but two nations struggling together in the maternal womb. Well, that's what it says. That's what the text says. And so she went to inquire of the Lord. She went to consult the oracle how this happened, as anybody's guess. Presumably she went to a priest in a sanctuary somewhere and was given the word from the Lord, two nations are in your womb, two peoples born of you shall be divided, the one shall be stronger than the other, the elder shall serve the younger. What does this mean for us? Who is the elder, who is the younger of the twins? Esau is the older, that's right, and Jacob is the younger, comes out second, and of course there's going to be a reversal of what's called primogeniture, the right of the firstborn, the right of the firstborn to inherit the property. We have it there in Deuteronomy chapter 21, verse 17, I don't think we've got time to look up all of the verses because we've got a lot of material to cover, but it's there in Deuteronomy 21, verse 17, where it's made very, very clear that the firstborn has the right to a double share in the property, come the death of the father. And so that's very much a reversal kind of situation here that soon follows. The first came out red. When it comes to the two nations, just thinking about them, what are the two nations we're talking about in the womb of Rebecca? So Israel on the one hand, Edom on the other. The Edomites, they continued to harass Israel throughout its history. And even when they went into Babylonian exile in the 6th century BC, the Edomites were there mocking and deriding and taunting. Psalm 137, somebody may like to look that up. Psalm 137, verse 7. Remember the day of the Edomites, the time of the fall of Jerusalem, how they said, tear it down, tear it down. A constant thorn in the side throughout Israel's history. First came out red. The word in Hebrew is Edom, very much related to the word Edom, which means reddish, right? Edom, the redskins. The red-fleshed people, very closely related to Adam. So there's this close relationship between Adam, Edom, the Edomites. And also he is the firstborn. He is a hairy man. How many jokes haven't been told about that? Esau was a hairy man, and hairy, Sa'ar, related to Seir, which is the alternate name for Edom. Right, Sa'ar, Seir, and Edom are synonyms. They both refer to the country of Edom. And the word Esau plays on the word for Seir. So all sorts of Bible is just full of these plays on words and etymological connections and puns and you name it. They just love it. So Edom meaning red, Seir, otherwise Edom, means basically hairy. So the first one who comes out is hairy. But the other bloke who comes out second is Jacob. And Jacob means heel, basically. And heel in Hebrew is very much like a heel in English. A sneak, a bit of a heel, a bit of a cunning person, a cheat, a supplanter. One who attempts to supplant another and take their place. Nomen est omen, is it not? Name is ominous. It is an omen of the kind of person that a person is or is predicted to be. So there is something ominous or ominous about the name of Jacob, the one who supplants. Already here in the womb, grabbing hold of the heel of Esau as the birth takes place. Something of what he is like is already foreshadowed in the birth event. When they grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, fisher, shooter, all of that kind of thing you can imagine, frontiersman, a wild man of the woods and so forth, loves hunting and shooting and fishing, catching game, and grilling it and barbecuing it and serving up all sorts of wonderful dishes. Can't we relate to that kind of a person, Esau? Jacob, on the other hand, a quiet man. The word is actually used of Noah, where it's translated as perfect, and it's used of other people. The adjective is much more exalted, but people found it typically difficult to translate this word for that's translated quiet, living in tents, mummy's boy, bookworm, all of that kind of thing associated with Jacob. People have found it hard to translate it as Noah, described in the same word, and others, where the word is perfect. And so they've said a quiet man, or a person who is self-contained and independent and loves to study, doesn't like to mix much with other people. Now, Jacob is this quiet, self-contained kind of a person who lives in tents, the bookworm. And the favoritism motif is introduced immediately here too, isn't it? Isaac loved, whom did he love? And Rebekah loved Jacob. Favoritism. Isaac also loved game. He loved the stews that were served up after the hunt was over. Whereas Rebekah was more the introspective one. She was the quiet one. Probably not so quiet, but she was certainly very active. We will see what an activist Rebekah is. Already in the story of the marriage between Rebekah and Isaac, she is the one who takes the initiative, isn't she? She really jumps on that horse and camels and so forth and heads back to Israel to be married to Isaac. And even when she gets back there, that's chapter 24, the very, very long chapter of the marriage of Isaac and Rebekah. Cunning, clever, sophisticated, interesting kind of a person is our Rebekah. The story of the birthright, the selling of the birthright, is very familiar to you. Interestingly, the word is Bekorah, and the word for blessing that we get in chapter 27 is Berakah. So the same consonants are used. Bekorah, B-K-R-H, with vowels in between, B-K-R-H, and the word for blessing, B-R-K-H. So the R and the K in Hebrew reversed. So there's obviously a play on words going on here. It's interesting, it reflects something of the character of Esau very, very quickly. We have a bit of a tendency in our appropriation of Esau to think of him as a bit of a good-natured nincompoop. Do we not? So easily duped out of his birthright and then out of his blessing. And that seems very much to be the case. But characters in the Old Testament aren't always as flat or one-dimensional as you necessarily get at first glance. Some of them are. You just get very much an epithet, a description is given of them, and we don't see much character development. But I believe that there's incredible development in the character of Esau, as we will see in subsequent weeks. But here, initially, he is outwitted big time. Outwitted big time by Jacob. Once when Jacob was cooking a stew, Esau came in from the field and he was famished. Verse 29, Esau said to Jacob, "Let me eat some of that red stuff." That red stuff, that's his name, that's his great love for the tummy and what goes into the tummy, especially if it's nice and juicy and rich and succulent. We're constantly having to think of these two characters as two nations. Right? Not simply the story of two men, but the story of two nations. And so we'll see, as we look at the whole of this Jacob cycle, as we'll call it, we'll see what kind of a picture does it paint of Israel's history. If his story is something of a reflection of Israel's story, or at least one take on Israel's story as found in the Old Testament. Right, he comes in famished. Therefore he was called Edom because of the relationship to the word red stuff. Jacob said, "First, sell me your birthright." And Esau, what an incredible response. "I'm about to die. What's the use to me of my birthright?" Famished means simply, you know, you're sort of a bit exhausted through spending a bit of time in the wilderness. You're probably more thirsty and tired than hungry. What you need is a good lie down, Bex, and a good lie down. That's what you need. In all the other references in the Old Testament to this word, he is not about to die by any stretch of the imagination. But you know that over-the-top kind of a statement that a person, "Oh, I'm going to die, I'm going to die." That's the kind of thing that you've got here. This is a funny story. It's a very funny story the way it is told. Now, Jacob has set this situation up. This is a setup, folks. He knows he's going to come in hungry, and so he's got his desk, he's got his writing pad, he's got all of his documentation out there, his pen, ready to sign on the bottom line to swear, and that word swear, to swear, has to do with a solemn oath. It's like writing up your will, this kind of thing. so that it's down in black and white. And so he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went his as clipped verbs. He ate and drank and rose and went his way. Not the Lord's way. His way, which is very much Jacob's planned way for Esau. And thus Esau despised his birthright. So the good-natured nincompoop, right, easily duped. And the cunning Jacob, on the other hand, supplanting him now as already the firstborn, getting the rights, the privileges, the inheritance of the firstborn, the major share of the property, the livestock, the goods and chattels that belong to the parents, to Isaac and Rebekah. Right, interesting material, and I would like us just to keep in that in the back of our minds for later on, when we see the final meeting of Jacob and Esau, a little bit later, and there's another tussle between the two, just after the River Jabbok incident, where they meet up again, and we'll ask ourselves the question, who then gets the upper hand? Who then wins the major tussle between Esau and Jacob? I think we'll skip chapter 26. We'll go straight to chapter 27 because that's where the weight lies, and I was hoping to get to that as quickly as I possibly could. When Isaac was old, his eyes were dim. I would encourage you and invite you to think of the senses as we read this chapter. The senses, sight, the hearing, taste, touch, feel, all of those sorts of other senses, taste and touch and feel. And think of Isaac very much in terms of the senses. So the eyes, where are the eyes up to? A bit dim. See, he called his eldest son Esau and said to him, "My son," and he answered, "Here I am." He said, "See, I am old. I do not know the day of my death." Well, none of us knows the day of our death, do we? But he means far more than that. He means, I could shuffle off any day. I could shuffle, you know, people who are like that too. I'm going to die tomorrow, virtually. How long does he survive after this statement? Quite some time. We know actually precisely how long he lives for, because Jacob goes off to Padan Aram, or Haran, called the two different names. He returns 20 years later, and Isaac is still around. So maybe a slight touch of hypochondria going on here. I could shuffle off any day. All right, so interesting chap. I think this is where I'd like to suggest that Isaac, a bit facetious, a bit tongue-in-cheek, suggests that he's been traumatized by that near-death experience on Mount Moriah when his father was about to sacrifice him to the Lord at the command of the Lord. It's had a telling effect. No, I don't know. Well, maybe it's in verse 34 of the previous chapter, when Esau was 40 years old, he married Judith, daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and Basemath. And these jolly two Hittite wives, so it's a case of bigamy on the part of Esau, is it not? They make life bitter in the household of Isaac and Rebekah. It's rather interesting. So maybe that too has had a telling effect on his health, and his sense of longevity is not as good as it might be. Yeah. It's interesting too, you compare him with Abraham at this particular point. Abraham was very, very eager that Isaac marry well, wasn't he? Not to marry among the Hittites, the locals, and so forth, but send his servant, arguably Eliezer, the name isn't given, in chapter 24, but sends his servant off to find a wife for Isaac. And that's where he finds Rebekah, for better or for worse. He finds Rebekah, but she belongs to the faith. She belongs to the family. She's the right. Here may be a little bit of negligence parentally on the part of Isaac in comparison with his father, Abraham, in terms of caring for and protecting and ensuring that he doesn't marry problematical people. I won't say women, problematical people. Could work the other way, of course, where a woman is advised against marry outside too much of those who are. But it's an interesting little point at this particular point that Isaac hasn't seen to and supervised and superintended the marriage of Esau, and that causes problems in the household.